The Juneau World Affairs Council, in cooperation with 360 North, presents Will China Rule the World? With Ronald Tammann. Tammann is an author and political science professor at Portland State University. His current research centers on China and India's emergence as world powers.
Thank you, Jim Clark, and to everyone here in the audience tonight, and to the city of Juneau. How beautiful and scenic it is here. I'm delighted to be with you. So the question is, will China overtake the United States in economic and military power? Let's not keep the suspense going. The answer is, well, of course they will. First in economic power, and then in military power. So let's look at the facts. China has 1.2 to 1.4 billion people. The United States has 300 million. That means that the average Chinese worker need only be one-fourth as productive as the average U.S. worker for China to have a GDP equal to the United States. Now, let's have a show of hands about something. How many of you in the audience think that it's impossible, it'll never happen, that the average Chinese worker is one quarter as productive as the average U.S. worker? Hands? Everybody thinks that it's quite likely. What would happen if the average Chinese worker is one half as productive as the average U.S. worker? Their GDP would be twice ours. And if they were equal in productive capacity to the United States or Japan or European workers, 4 to 5 times the size of the economy of the United States. Simple math. When will this occur? In 1988, when I first wrote about this, I predicted it would happen in 2015. The Economist magazine study tells us it will happen in 2019. Goldman Sachs thinks it'll be 2027. The World Bank likes 2015 and 2020. Whatever the date, it's now a commonly accepted fact that one day soon, Americans will wake up to the headlines in the newspaper, on their iPads, and on television that say, China overtakes the U.S. in economic power. Their economy has grown 7 times as fast as the U.S. over the past 10 years. Put another way, they've had 30 years of 8 to 10% growth, and we struggle to achieve 3%. That said, China still has a long way to go to catch up with GDP per capita. Right now, GDP per capita income for the U.S. is around $50,000, while China is $9,000. Per capita GDP measures personal wealth. National GDP measures the resources available to the central government for investment in the economy or the military or both. That's why we should keep our eye on both numbers, but particularly national GDP. The Chinese workforce is dynamic and growing. Think of this. They have a floating workforce, not permanent, but a floating workforce of 150 million men. What's the entire workforce of the United States? Anybody take a guess? 155 million. Every day, more inefficient rural workers are becoming more efficient and productive Chinese urban workers. China is building 20 new cities the size of Portland, Oregon, or larger every year. You've probably seen the news reports that a few of them are unoccupied. They're called ghost cities. But the Chinese have a plan to fix that. They're going to move in people from the rural areas. In fact, the greatest migration in human history is about to occur in China, as 400 million rural Chinese are moved, willingly or unwillingly, to cities. There'll be 1 billion Chinese living in urban areas by 2030. They will have 221 cities over 1 million in population. How many U.S. cities are above 1 million in population? Somebody like to take a guess? 9. Here's another statistic that astounds me. 21% of China is under the age of 14. Now, that doesn't sound like a large percentage, but think of it as an actual number. And the actual number of under 14 individuals in China is greater than the population of the United Kingdom and France and Italy and Germany combined. That's a lot of young workers. Driven by the need for foreign resources and fueled by competition with the United States, the Chinese military is undergoing a sustained technologically driven growth curve. There are 800 short-range ballistic missiles across the Straits of Taiwan, pointed at Taiwan. The Chinese are developing a second strike strategic force. You remember that term from the Cold War. They could absorb a full attack on Chinese facilities and still retaliate overwhelmingly. They have the second largest defense budget in the world and the largest land army. They have a strategy to protect the sea lanes to the Middle East, to deny Taiwan independence, to exploit the South China Sea, to maintain peaceful borders by force if necessary, and to quell by any means domestic opposition from minority populations, be they Tibetan, Uyghur, Mongolian, or Kazakh. Make no mistake about it, even if China suffers a cataclysmic setback, they will still become the most powerful country in the world. Nonsense, you say. I can hear you. Countries recover from the unthinkable. Consider Germany and Japan. They were defeated in war. They had their countries occupied by foreign forces. They had new forms of government imposed upon them. They suffered huge population losses. They were set back economically with vast destruction of their economic capacity. These were all cataclysmic events. And within 20 years, both countries recovered to their dynamic pre-war growth rates. But wait a minute. Perhaps I'm not being fair in this analysis. After all, there are many renowned experts in government and the academy that argue that China, while continuing to grow somewhat, will fail to become the world's leading power. And I keep an open mind, and I'm willing to be convinced. So I'm going to present all of their arguments for fairness, and so you can hear me out and hear them out. What are these compelling arguments about China failing? Well, the Communist Party is losing support in rural areas and perhaps elsewhere in China. There's criticism of the party, although still muted, creeping into print here and there and on the social networks. Democracy may prevail over time. We're having some local elections in China now, and they may show the way. Or there could be top-down reforms as well. With democratic reforms, China may no longer feel the need to compete for international power. Or the country may fracture, as did the USSR. Look at Tibet and Xinjiang province today and the unrest there. Or an overheated real estate economy could crash, as the housing and occupancy crisis currently portends. Already we see ghost buildings and ghost cities and deserted theme cities. An aging population increasingly is stressing the financial integrity of China. China could go the way of Japan and parts of Europe with too few supporting too many. By 2020, the ratio of workers to retirees will be 3-1, leading to a third of China's population being over 60 years old by 2040. The one-child policy has mandated, in effect, that one child and spouse will end up having to support four parents plus grandparents. Healthcare, an enormous problem for China, as there virtually is none at the governmental level. It's an expensive potential drag on the Chinese economy. Pollution. Waterways are polluted. Cities have particulates so thick that visibility is limited to a single block. Forests have been cut down. Animal species extirpated. 8 to 20% of all the arable land in China is contaminated with heavy metals. Many studies indicate that pollution will have significant economic and health consequences for China. And pollution is expensive to remediate after the fact, as we know. Water shortages. Tibetan glaciers that supply China's great rivers are disappearing by 7% a year. Half of the rivers that existed in China in 1990 have dried up. 75% of those that remain are polluted. Energy. Energy shortages could curtail growth, and new sources of energy in the Middle East are very unreliable. The Middle East, after all, is the most volatile region of the world, as we've found out. There could be regional disputes between the have and have-not provinces, the rich versus the poor, the rich east, the poor west, which could curtail growth and foster regional frictions. The banking system is rife with bad loans, often based upon non-producing real estate, particularly owned by state-owned industry and high-level officials in the Communist Party. This could cascade into an economic collapse of the country, much like it did in Southeast Asia in 1997. Bird flu or swine contagion could cause severe economic dislocations, creating quarantines and mass deaths and economic stagnation. Or there could be a civil war or a regional war with India as a result of a number of these factors. Not to mention corruption. Corruption is endemic to China. It could crush the entrepreneurial spirit and foster severe discontent among the general population. When the princes and the princelings, the sons and daughters of the new wealth, race around the country in their Maseratis and Ferraris and occasionally kill a poor peasant, it confirms that society has become corrupt and uneven. The gender balance is creating a population of surplus men. Eventually, 1 in 5 Chinese men will be hopelessly single. This could cause enormous societal disruptions. Any one of these challenges could bring down a country, and in concert, they are impossible to overcome. Let me repeat that. Any one of these challenges could bring down a country, and in concert, overwhelmingly impossible to overcome. So, have I convinced you now that China faces such challenges that they can never really compete with the United States? Isn't that a very strong case? Many eminent scholars say so. Okay, let's take another tack at it. Let's take a snapshot of the United States before the turn of the 20th century, in the early 1900s. We just come through a disastrous civil war, which created long-term fissures in society, a large regional war which destroyed transportation and agriculture and industry. We were busy polluting our streams and rivers and cutting down entire forests. We were killing off the last of the bison. We were destroying the environment. Smoke covered our northern cities. Rivers were burning with effluent. There were 13 fires in the Cuyahoga River alone beginning in 1868, where the river was on fire. Oligarchs are running the country. Railroad and financial barons. A few wealthy families are controlling production. It is an uneven society. Gould Harriman, Hill, Mellon, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Carnegie, John Jacob Astor, all with their own princes and princelings driving around the country in new cars. Vast wealth for a few, poverty for many immigrants and rural Americans. There were race riots in major cities, lynchings in the South. Society was in turmoil. There was severe anti-immigration frictions, religious bigotry, anti-Catholic demonstrations, signs on establishments saying, no Jews, no blacks, no Irish, no Germans, no Italians, please. But their terms weren't as polite as those I just used. There was vast corruption at all levels of government. Tammany Hall, big city machines like Chicago, vote buying, corruption of senators and House members and cabinet members and the judiciary and police forces. There were payoffs and bribes galore. Pandemics. There were huge outbreaks of influenza, polio, cholera, dysentery, malaria, TB, typhoid fever, yellow fever. High death rates for children and the elderly. 675,000 people died of the Spanish flu in 1918 alone. 50 million worldwide. Remember Typhoid Mary in 1906? Working in the houses of some of the rich families on the East Coast and passing along typhoid to those family members, which caused the very first revolution in American health care. Smallpox, meanwhile, was devastating the Native American population from an estimated 12 million to 237,000 in the early 1900s. Healthcare in the United States? Not a chance for most. Gender imbalance? Certainly the case in the west of the United States and Alaska. So what would you conclude by looking at this snapshot in the early 1900s? You'd have to conclude that this country will never succeed. It will never make it. There are too many intractable problems, any one of which could bring it down, but taken in concert, impossible to overcome. Sound familiar? So we come to this. Is the United States so unique, so special, so industrious, so exceptional, that it could survive all of these challenges while all other countries in similar circumstances will fail? What do you think? What does it mean if I am correct about China becoming the most powerful country in the world eventually? Well, early on, after the collapse of the USSR in 1990, the United States went through a period that I call enemy deprivation. We did not have an enemy on the horizon. But this eventually gave way to two camps regarding China, the conflict versus cooperation, or strategic engagement versus strategic competition, Clinton versus Bush. And more recently, we have President Obama with his pivot toward Asia, which is one of the most important foreign policy initiatives of the post-Soviet era and the least well-known. How are the Chinese responding? They have a slogan, strong economy, strong army. They took that from us. We had a very weak army before World War I and before World War II, but we had a strong economy. We were able to take that economy and turn it into a vibrant, world-class, dominating military. So the Chinese have adopted a page from our American political history, really, by understanding the importance of economic development first. And they're doing other things. They've systematically gone around their country resolving border disputes to help create a launch pad launching into the international system. And they're doing international posturing with slogans, but these slogans have very clever secondary messages. For example, their non-interference doctrine, saying the country should not interfere in the affairs of another country. And by the way, that means don't interfere inside China. Don't interfere in Hong Kong. Don't interfere with Taiwan. their slogan about peaceful rising or peaceful development, made to assure neighbors that this growth in power is not threatening, and their regional engagement in multilateral organizations. So what are these Chinese leaders thinking, and what forms their thought process? It's a very difficult subject for anyone to take on. I'll give you some hints, perhaps, from my own reflection about this. If you were a Chinese leader, what domestic events have conditioned your worldview? Whether it was the Great Leap Forward, 700 million Chinese placed in communes in 1958 to 60, building backyard furnaces so that they could match the United States in output by 1988. There was the Red Guards period from 66 to 76, the Cultural Revolution, that touched almost every Chinese family, including high-level military officials. How would you, as a Chinese leader, view your region? I once went to a military firepower demonstration in southern China in the city of Guilin, the military district of Guilin, and I was taken to their military museum. It was a series of walls. The first wall had pictures of military officers' photographs, and it was explained to me that that wall had photographs of the officers from this unit who had died fighting in Tibet in 1951. And the next wall, fighting in Korea in 50 and 53. The third wall, fighting in Vietnam from 59 to 75. The fourth wall, fighting in India in 1962. The fifth wall, fighting the Soviet Union in 1969, a very bitter battle. And the last wall, fighting the Vietnamese again in 1979. By the way, the Vietnamese acquitted themselves quite well. Now look geographically as this leader. You look north, there's a nuclear power, North Korea, and the United States is ensconced in South Korea. Look west, Russia, a nuclear power that betrayed the revolution. Look south, two nuclear powers, Pakistan and India, plus Vietnam. Look east, and you find the floating Western aircraft carrier called Taiwan, plus hated Japan. So how would we react if Canada and Mexico were hostile and had nuclear weapons, and if British Columbia was an independent country with nukes run by an unpredictable and perhaps irrational leader? You also see things as a leader in China. You see unrest in Tibet and unrest in Xinjiang province. You see foreign hands meddling, the Dalai Lama, Turkey supporting the Uyghurs, radical Islamists, Western religions, cults, the internet, Western concepts of law and human rights, infections all, cancers that must be cut out. You understand the threat of 150-man mobile working force inside China, and you know you have to keep them busy at all costs. You have to keep them employed, and that's why you must have 8% real growth a year for your economy. Otherwise, what do you do with all these men? You see the threat of the free enterprise sector eroding the power of the party. And that, above all else, is unacceptable. You not only see, but you remember. You have good history. You remember the time of troubles, the two opium wars of 1839 to 42 and 1856 to 60, resulting in the unequal treaties, the loss of Hong Kong, humiliation and weakness for China. You remember the Boxer Rebellion of 1900, which brought further humiliation to China, and Western interventions and concessions. You call this something special. You call it a period of swallowing bitterness. You remember the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931, the rape of Nanking in 1937. You remember the Japanese military Unit 37, which practiced vivisection on Chinese prisoners. You remember experiments using chemical weapons, biological weapons, medical experiments on Chinese POWs. You remember the great patriotic civil war and how the Americans sided with the Kuomintang before and afterwards. You remember crossing the Yalu River when your warnings were disregarded by the Americans. More recently, you've been embarrassed to have to back down in a series of crises involving Taiwan. You continue to swallow bitterness, but you have patience because you know your time is coming. So what must the world be ready for? It must be ready for a different set of rules of the road, an Asian-based set of rules. We can follow the money. Chinese investments abroad will be followed by Chinese diplomatic support activity, which in turn will be followed by Chinese military support. There's already evidence of this in the Middle East. And what is the best we can hope for? We can hope that Chinese leaders become socialized into the existing international system in such a way that little will change when their power increases exponentially, much as what happened when the United States assumed the mantle of world leadership from the United Kingdom. If this is to happen, then it is the special obligation of the U.S. business community to bring this about. Unlike during the Cold War, where there were no business ties between Russia and the United States, reciprocal business relationships between China and the U.S. create golden handcuffs which will have a moderating influence on Chinese power and may help to change the nature of Chinese governance as well. But none of this will matter if the U.S. pursues a posture of alienating and deliberately provoking the Chinese during their fast growth period. If they have to continue swallowing bitterness, then when they are powerful, they will reorganize the international system based on their own principles, replacing the World War II world that in large measure we, the United States, designed and instituted. So we all have an obligation to help frame how China sees the world and deals with the world in the years to come. And we can't wait until after the fact. We have to start today. Thank you for your attention. I'd be glad to take any questions on this or, frankly, any other subject. Please go to the microphone and.
Well, in light of what you said, then how do you think the current situation in Hong Kong is going to resolve itself? How?
It appears to me that the officials in Hong Kong are going to wait this situation out because the consequences of taking action are too dire. No one wants a second Tiananmen Square. But on the other hand, Chinese leaders do not want this infection to spread to the mainland. There's already evidence that there are gatherings in Macau, another special administrative area, and there have been demonstrations in Taiwan. If this were to spread to some mainland traditional Chinese city, then I think the reaction by the leadership of China would be much more forceful. Right now, they're going to sit on the sidelines, I believe, and wait it out.
Yeah, well, the thing, too, though, this is Golden Week, and you have a lot of Chinese from the mainland who are in Hong Kong. They're witnessing this firsthand. They're filming it on their cell phones, and I suspect there are going to be a lot of thumb drives going back to China.
Undoubtedly, social media has played a role in this. The demonstrators in the streets of Hong Kong are slightly different than the demonstrators we saw in North Africa or the Middle East. They were brought together by social media, but they're younger. They're high school kids in many cases, rather than college kids or college students. And that's a little bit of a new phenomenon. So we'll have to wait and see as well if the leadership of China decides to take forceful action. They would bring in troops from Manchuria or some other part of China to help put this down rather than to let the police force of Hong Kong repress their own people, which they probably will not.
I would just like to know what languages you speak.
Occasionally English and Russian. When I went to school, I was the middle of the Cold War, and so there was a focus on Russia, which I had, but I had a lingering feeling that we were not conducting our strategic thinking properly, that Russia wasn't the long-term problem, because the Russian economy was going like this, and ours was going like this, and the gap was widening. And I said, if the gap is widening, something is going to break along the line somewhere. So Russia, I did not think, was the problem. They didn't have a large enough population to challenge the United States in the long run. But China did. And so I gave a version of this speech in 1988. And, you know, I would start off and the first two rows of people would get up and leave in protest. And I would get through the middle of my speech and the second two rows would get up. Finally, there was just this one gray-haired lady in the back sitting in my audience. And I said, "Well, Mom, how did I do?" And she thought I did very well, of course. It was unpopular to talk about China in those days, but I intuitively realized, and I studied under a great professor who had similar ideas, that the world needed to focus even then, long-term on China because of the potential that they had compared to any other country on Earth except India. And India's a topic for another day. Just a social politeness, and probably not very well at that. But I should. And if I were starting all over again, I would. I would buy RMB, and I would study Chinese.
So several decades ago, when the United States changed our recognition under the leadership of Tricky Dick, as we called him then, and acknowledged reality, we didn't exactly throw Taiwan under the bus. It's more like we put it on the bike rack. But what? It's obviously an unstable situation. What's the long-term or medium-term outlook for Taiwan?
Well, Taiwan is a flashpoint for the Chinese. I've gone on a number of diplomatic missions to China. And quite literally, when you would get off the plane and come down the gangplank on the plane, your minder, the military officer that was assigned to be your escort, would start whispering in your ear something like the following: "You must understand that China will pay any price, will make any sacrifice, will lose as many people as necessary to make sure that Taiwan stays a part of mainland China." This is the most serious geographic issue for the Chinese. It's become quiet in the last few years because the movement for independence in Taiwan has dissipated, and the political parties have seemed to incorporate that with some degree of aplomb. The long-term solution is going to be some sort of two entities, two different government structures, one country. And that's where we're headed with it. I once made a proposal in Taiwan that both sides should take some confidence-building measures. The Taiwanese should send military officers to serve in the military units across the Straits of Taiwan, and the Chinese mainland should send military officers to serve with the Taiwanese forces on Taiwan and Quemoy and Matsu islands. It was taken seriously. I think it's something like that would help in the long run to tamp down the tensions in the Taiwan Straits. But it is the number one flashpoint between China and the United States in the long run. If we were to engage into conflict with China over Taiwan, right now we have the military capability to be successful. But it would forever taint the way the Chinese think about the United States, and there would be no hope of rapprochement after that, none, for 40 or 50 years. because their memories are long and they would not want to swallow bitterness again. So it's a very important question, must be dealt with very delicately. After all, Taiwan's a functioning democracy, and it's not something you want to willingly give up, so you have to protect their rights. It may be that Taiwan, in the long run, maintains its economic independence, but gives up its foreign policy to the mainland, and a shared national security responsibility between the two. Very delicate, difficult to do.
Hope I didn't get in front of the camera there. When you're talking about challenges that might be hard for China to surmount, the one that's a big deal building for us that you mentioned, I think, which I'd love to know your thoughts on, is inequality. Because they're getting great economic growth and wealth in China, but it's not shared. In kind of a related topic, the other thing that comes to my mind that might be a big challenge existentially for China is an internal leadership crisis. And the nightmare scenario I think of is Saddam Hussein taking power through his little Congress with killing his adversaries. And I don't know what you think of the potential is for something like that happening within the internal governing structure of the Communist Party. So I'd just like to know what you think of it.
The inner workings of the Communist Party in China remain something of a black box to all observers. We think we know a good deal about it, but what we're operating on is hearsay, second and third party renditions of what happened behind closed doors. There does seem to be check and balance within the party at the highest level. There's no one leader in recent years that has had absolute authority to make radical changes in their policy. The military still has a significant say, although they've been eclipsed by the civilian leadership over the last 10 years. Could there be something explosive inside the party that would then touch off the secondary fires around the country? It's possible, because we don't really know the mechanisms all that well. I don't expect that to happen, because above all else, what is valued there is the role and the control of the party. And the party will always make a self-interested decision about what is good for the party, even over what is good for the nation. And that's traditionally been the case, because the party is the vanguard of thinking and it knows best. And that's even the current President Xi, and in his nationalistic rhetoric, gives rise to an understanding that they are not willing to share power from the top down currently.
Sir, thank you for your cogent remarks about China. I appreciated that. However, I'm thinking of India. Is it a potential also for this? I mean, their population may soon exceed China, and who knows what's going to happen on that front.
Thank you very much. It's a very important question. And you're going to have to invite me back next year to address that at a little more length. But India made a couple of fundamental mistakes. It tied its future to the Soviet Union 20 or 30 years ago, rather than looking to the West. It put into place a command-style economy, terribly inefficient. While the Chinese unleashed their economy, they kept their controls, their social controls, socialistic controls on the economy, and it has not paid off for them. Only in recent years have they realized that they have fallen behind China in terms of economic development and have tried to make some internal reforms. They also adopted the Soviets' foreign policy and became leader of the non-aligned movement. And where is the non-aligned movement these days? It just kind of disappeared in 1990 when the Soviet Union went away. So they made some fundamental bad strategic choices as a country. And they're trying to rectify that now. By 2050, India will have more population than China. they're sitting on each other's border. There's a good deal of tension between those two countries, even though they resolved most of the border disputes in recent years. I think that's one of the most delicate issues in the world for the world community to keep an eye on, is the tension between India and China, because neighbors of significant size, large economies, large military establishments that share a given part of the world almost always find a way not to get along. And I think that's probably what will happen. Very dangerous situation. And the United States needs to make sure it has an extremely good relationship with India, which it has not had over time. It's very important because of the rise of China.
Thank you for coming to visit us in Juneau and share your knowledge. In remote areas in Africa and in South America, I've come across Chinese engineers, which was kind of startling. Does China have enough resources of its own to accomplish what we're talking about, or is it dependent on going into other countries and exploiting their resources?
The latter, clearly. And they've been doing it in the Middle East for 10 years. About 3 years ago, I went to the Middle East to brief a couple of governments about the penetration of the Middle East economically by China and India. People don't realize that India is also involved in signing up long-term oil, natural gas agreements in the Middle East. And the Chinese, in thinking even farther down the field, have begun to buy agricultural land in Africa and securing rights to rare minerals that are needed for manufacturing in Africa. The Chinese have no inhibitions about dealing with countries with terrible human rights problems. The economy is first and is the highest priority for the country. So they'll deal with anyone, sign a lease with anyone, and will send their engineers, their workers, Chinese, just average Chinese workers, off to build dams and roads in these countries in order to secure a toehold in them for economic reasons. And once they have an economic relationship with those countries, they're going to protect it. And you protect it first, as I said a little earlier, with diplomatic activity. You beef up your embassy. You support that country in votes of self-interest for that country in the United Nations and other places. And you then, as a country, support your diplomatic activity with military activity. You send your fleet over there as a demonstration of support if necessary. And you build a blue water navy. You build a rapid reaction military force that can reach out to any place in the world. That's coming. And that's coming because the Chinese have these widespread worldwide economic interests. We did the same thing.
How do you see the U.S. pivot toward Asia, and what are the implications of that on your analysis?
I think the strategy of a pivot toward Asia was a brilliant move, but has been overcome by events in the Middle East, because our focus is still and remains still so solidly on the Middle East. We lurch from one crisis to another. And yet the pivot toward Asia is the most important long-term theme that needs to be carried out, which means reassuring our allies that Chinese growth will not be threatening, because we will still be there. Imagine that you're a country living in the neighborhood of China, and China is growing so rapidly. Well, you're going to be nervous about this big brother next to you, and what will it do sometime in the future. So you need the reassurance that you have an ally somewhere in the world that is going to give you some support. That's what the pivot was designed to do, without directly challenging the Chinese and without telling the Chinese that what we're trying to do is to encircle them, because that would inflame our relationship with them. So it was building on existing relationships and reassuring countries there that the United States is not withdrawing from Asia, but is going to redouble our efforts there, overcome by, tragically, by events in the Middle East. Somebody mentioned Saddam Hussein a minute ago. I have to say this. We didn't think strategically about the decision to invade the second time and get rid of Saddam Hussein. What happened as a result of that is we made Iran the most important country in the Middle East by getting rid of its only natural competitor, Iraq. Right? There were no terrorist hubs of activity in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Now, don't get me wrong. He was a ruthless fanatic. He killed off Kurds. He killed off the Shiite population. He was brutal in every way. But one thing he did not allow was for terrorist organizations to operate on his territory. If Saddam Hussein were alive today and running Iraq, you would not find terrorist organizations there. He would have systematically wiped them out because they've been a threat to him. Now, I'm not saying we should have kept him in power either, but it's a reflection about the inadequacy of not thinking strategically when you make a decision. You make a decision based upon the factors of the moment. You think this is the right thing to do, but sometimes you don't understand, you don't see, you don't think about the secondary and the tertiary ramifications of your actions and what will happen 4, 5, and 10 years later. That was a free, paid observation.
I just wanted to ask about the rare earth metals. You mentioned that briefly, and I may be wrong here, but I think China is fairly resource wealthy in rare earth metals, and they're more important with the information technology today. What thoughts do you have on your thoughts of the
They have certain reserves of rare earth metals in China, mainly in western China and the Gobi Desert area, but not all of them that they need. And so they are trying to secure more from Africa. The United States does not have the same type of reserves of the critical rare earth trace minerals. And so it's of great importance to us and to our continuing technological development that we do have access to those or find substitutes for them. There is something like a covert, quiet race to secure those in the world by a number of parties, the United States, Japan, China, India, and to a lesser degree, the Germans and the Europeans. So there's a lot of competition there. And it's important.
I had a follow-up question on you're mentioning that the biggest threat you thought was India, but I'm just curious why you weren't as worried about Russia. Years ago, I had read someone who convinced me it seemed reasonable that because of the rising economic power and their vast population advantage, they might want to gobble up some of the land over history they've lost to Russia. Is there some risk of that in, say, Siberia or maybe Mongolia? And I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, in 1990, when Russia imploded, it lost one-third of its population, one-third of its or more of its productive capacity. It lost ICBM bases and atomic energy facilities in the Ukraine and Kazakhstan. And it's never really recovered from that, coupled with the fact that it has a population that a certain segment of its population that is drinking itself to death. And I say this quite literally because the data is in that Russian men are declining in longevity year by year. For health reasons and because of the breakdown of the health system and a number of other societal issues. So I don't see the Russians as a global threat to anyone at this time. Now, they certainly are a regional threat, as we've seen in the Ukraine and associated areas. They can tamper. They can probe and prod. They can cause problems and anxieties and headaches, but they can't challenge another country outright. They don't have the productive capacity for it, and they do not have the population that will ever put them into the category of being able to compete with either India or China. My view. I'm sure Mr. Putin probably feels
the other corollary was, what were your thoughts on an accidental war in South China Sea with Japan? I know that's been kind of a flashpoint.
The growing importance of China in that part of the world is going to make countries in the area nervous. And some of those countries are going to say, well, it's time for us to switch allegiances and to move toward China. Others, including Japan, are going to reinforce the relationship with the United States and move more toward the United States. So I think we'll see a closer relationship develop over time with Japan, which is very important. I don't foresee the Chinese wanting to engage in military combat with Japan, despite the fact that they don't like them very much. They don't like the Japanese very much because of some of the things I talked to you about earlier. But they want to secure their economic development rights without open conflict. Open conflict sends the wrong message to all the countries that live in that part of the world. Now, the last thing I'll say about it is that they can whip up xenophobic feelings about Japan in 24 hours. If the leadership says something about Japan, the streets can be filled with Chinese overnight, and not just because of party loyalty, because there really is this feeling of animosity toward the Japanese people that may not go away until another generation occurs. So I don't see warfare occurring there. I do see a lot of significant tension over time.
Would you comment on relations of some of the border countries with China, Vietnam, Korea, and both North and South?
Vietnam obviously has made the choice that it's going to get closer and closer to the United States, one of the few countries in the world where an American can go visit there and be welcomed in open arms and feel completely safe. A remarkable transformation of relationships between two countries perhaps hasn't happened anywhere else in the world in similar circumstances. South Korea and North Korea, the relationship there has changed so dramatically, the South has become so potent and powerful economically that I don't see tensions there. The North Koreans, for a lot of reasons, are very adroit at practicing combat diplomacy and making the most outrageous statement possible to make everybody nervous. But they don't actually act on it because they're coming at this from a position of weakness. The other countries in Southeast Asia and Asia are going to have to make a choice in the next 20 years. Do they want to realign themselves with China, or do they want to maintain a relationship with the West? And I think those are going to fall out almost predictably. The key, for all of us to keep in mind, the key country that no one talks about is Indonesia. Indonesia is the giant of that part of the world, and as goes Indonesia, will go Southeast Asia. So thank you very much for your time and attention. It's been a delight for me to be here, to come to Juneau for the first time, and enjoy this spectacular day. Thank you.
That was Ronald Tammann speaking about China's emergence in this Juneau World Affairs Council presentation, produced in collaboration with 360 North. It was recorded on October 1st, 2014 at 360 in Juneau with support from GCI, Alaska Electric Light and Power Company, Wastman & Associates Incorporated, Core Alaska Incorporated, Hecla Greens Creek Mining Company, Sea Alaska, and Alaska Power and Telephone.